Welcome back to Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. It is a pleasure to have you with us this morning, and it is a pleasure to have Jean Creighton in the studio with us this morning as well. Hello, Jean.
Hello, Bonnie.
It is wonderful to see you, and always look forward to our conversations. And today I wanted to start with basically what is the bread and butter for all scientists, and that is data. The way I understand it, it's how you do what you do.
Mm-hmm.
And so how does this work with astronomy? Over the months, the years that we've been doing this, we've talked about, you know, getting data from different kinds of telescopes, different kinds of instruments. So maybe let's talk about it itself. How do we go about collecting this stuff and determining what's important?
Great question. I was thinking it might be fun to talk about this from the point of view of somebody who's kind of new to the field, say, for example, a graduate student, or a person, a scientist who used to do specific research in this field but now has moved to a different subfield. And as it's very clear when you read the Astrophysical Journal, people specialize in small pieces of the overall picture just because we know so much about so much. It's hard to become an expert in very large areas of expertise. I remember when I was a graduate student reading journals and it seemed like a foreign language. Things would be explained with terms that I didn't know, so you'd have to go to that reference and read about that, and then in that paper there'd be other things that you'd never heard of before, and it really was like reading, you know, a newspaper in a foreign language where there's so many words you don't know that you kind of have to go back and back and back to the basics that you recognize and understand. Well, after you do that for a few months, then you start getting a better sense of what has been done in the field, because naturally sometimes the questions that you have about certain topics, let's say star formation, well, they've been asked before, and there's a healthy literature on those topics. So the next task then becomes, of the problems that you're wondering about, which ones have already been attempted? And in some cases, the response is fairly conclusive, and we all agree, yep, that's how it should be. But sometimes the issue might be supposedly concluded, but you might think that, oh, I bring a different perspective to this question, and maybe I can add something new.
To the body of knowledge.
Yeah, and that my perspective changes the way I would ask the question or try and answer the question, and therefore come up with a slightly more nuanced response. So different perspectives can be, I'm used to using different instruments. So, for example, well, maybe for this star-forming region, all the data is in the infrared. But what would happen if I started looking in the X-rays, for example? Or what would happen if I used a different resolution of telescope? So sometimes it's a matter of using different eyes or a finer, if you will, a smaller pixel in your picture. Or I need more data points. So there are a lot of now surveys in the sky that take pictures of large regions repeatedly. And sometimes that indicates that things change in ways that we didn't even appreciate because nobody was looking often enough to see those changes.
Now, if you're that new graduate student who's trying to find something to specialize in or a question that hasn't been answered, I'm assuming that professors and other more advanced people in the field are going to be able to direct you to some of this data they're going to be able to say, well, no, that actually has been asked just like that by so-and-so.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. No, and certainly that's why, I mean, I think graduate students don't exist in vacuum. They usually are in an academic environment, so they can benefit from the context that the more experienced people would have. I think that's one of the most common problems with a graduate student's first steps is that you really don't know all the context that your research falls in. So you think you are all caught up in this little problem, but you don't realize always what the bigger picture is. And the bigger picture comes as you do more work yourself, as you become more aware in conferences or in just private communications what other people are working on.
I know there's a lot that we already know. But there's, of course, so much more to learn, probably infinity of things to learn out there. How do you decide when you're a graduate student? Do you get the direction from your advisor that basically says, you know, you really should push your interest in this direction because nobody's really doing that?
Well, I think there are a couple of considerations. One is what is considered, you know, a hot topic or an interesting topic. So not all problems are equal in importance. So certain topics, like say, for example, if you can come up with good ideas about how whole galaxies form, well, that's a pretty interesting problem, or exactly the details of how the solar system has come to be the way it is, especially considering all the other solar systems we're finding beyond our own. These are really big questions, and they seem to attract the attention of many people, which usually means that funding comes with that, that you can get publications, that you can get, you know, you get invited to conferences to give talks. Obviously, some questions are a little more obscure, and in those situations, you don't have the same kind of resources. So sometimes people choose to go for the big time, although sometimes the big problems are harder to crack, and it might take a longer time for you to make that real progress. Or people choose the smaller, more doable problems that might not have the same glamour, but they might be more attainable. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it absolutely does. One of the things that would daunt me would be just the sheer volume of data that's there to go through, even if you're narrowing your specialty down. But if you're a cosmologist, say, mm-hmm. that's your job, is to understand the whole thing.
Right. But I think just starting with small little pieces like, let's read this paper, let's understand what it basically says, is an overwhelming in and of itself. I don't think that graduate students, and it's probably just as well, sit there and ponder how much they don't know, because that really would make you, I think, run for the hills. But what is true is that sometimes there's quite a bit of luck involved. So, for example, when you're working with somebody, chances are they have some data that they would love to analyze, but they simply don't have time. So sometimes a project lands in your lap and you're trying to analyze the data and make sense of it. And that might be exactly what you say, oh, this is totally cool. This is what I want to do. This is the sort of project I'm interested in. Or you might say, okay, well, I'm happy to wrap this up. I want to finish the analysis, write the paper, but I know now this is not the kind of problem that I'm interested in. But it's nice to get your feet wet.
And also, again, to add to the body of knowledge, mm-hmm. because somebody else might build on that.
Oh,
or take it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's any paper that is of no consequence to anybody, but some papers might be referenced, you know, in, say, 10 years, 5 times, and some papers could be referenced in 5 years, 2,000 times. Obviously, they're not of the same importance to the community overall. So for most people, eventually, you don't have data that's sitting around. Eventually, you have to actually get this data. And normally, that involves talking to researching observatories that have the kind of sensitivity or wavelength or all of the above that you require. And then you put in a proposal. You write an observing proposal and say, this is the data that I would like. This is the kind of questions that I'm going to ask. Here's how am I going to analyze the data. And these are all the lovely papers that I've written in the past so that you believe that I will actually do something with this data. Most telescopes are oversubscribed, in some cases 3-to-1, in some cases 10-to-1. So that means that all things being equal, your chances of getting time are 30% probably at best in most facilities, in some cases 10% at best. So then you hope, you wait usually for typically a few months, and the time allocation committee for that facility will decide whether your problem is interesting enough, whether it's feasible, because you could propose something marvelous that they think actually realistically this instrument can't do, how likely you are to publish. And of course, they know already if somebody has collected the very data that you proposed already. Usually an author, so the principal investigator for the data, will have a full year of lead time before the data becomes public. And that's to put some pressure on the author, some urgency that you need to write the paper before you get scooped, because if the data becomes public in principle, somebody else could do the analysis that you were hoping to do, and it's gone.
And
they publish first. In the happy event that you get the paper and you analyze it, you start to actually, as you're writing the paper or doing the analysis, you're probably talking to colleagues to get a sense of, you know, are there things that you might have overlooked? Sometimes, you know, over coffee, people will say, oh, did you consider da-da-da? And you feel like a fool because you think, no, I didn't consider that. Or sometimes you think, oh, yeah, I did consider that, but la-la-la-la-la. And now you can, you know, discuss with some, in some detail with this person the marvelous thoughts that you had on the topic. Eventually, as you think more through the details of your research, then you can present it at conferences. And of course, you write the papers, which means that the next time you look for data, you have a stronger position. And of course, most often the data that you collect will generate new questions. And the story continues.
Usually it just doesn't end. There's going to be, you know, more questions raised and you're going to need more data to answer those questions.
That's right. So that's why I was considering your question, well, do you get just overwhelmed by all the stuff you don't know? No, because I think you kind of dive into it. And as you ponder this particular question, more things come up. Often there's surprises. You think you know what the data is going to be. You think you know what's going to come out of it. And sometimes you get a little bit of that, but often you get a surprise. And now you have to figure out, well, is there something about my methodology, something I did with the analysis that screwed up the result? Or is this fundamentally a shift in what I thought was true, and now I need to rearrange my understanding of the topic?
How often does that latter happen? Or is it more a methodology problem when that happens? Or how often are people really finding new things or new ways to think about things?
I think it depends on how mature the topic is. If it's a topic, you know, a lot of people have been working on things. If you come up with something utterly new, chances are, and most people aren't agreeing with you, chances are good that there's some hiccup in the analysis. And it could be a computer issue, a modeling issue. It could be the way that you analyze the raw data. But if a field is fairly young, then it's surprising sometimes what we didn't know. Then lots of surprises happen. Let me give you an example for, I'm thinking of asteroids. We've been sending now for the last, let's say 20 years or so, we've been sending a few. There's a handful now of machines that have gone to an asteroid or close to an asteroid, and we've seen it from the outside, reasonably close up. Until then, we thought that asteroids are rocky materials, potato-shaped, pretty dense. I mean, not obviously as dense as Earth, but the density of stone. When you get close up to some of them, you realize, no, this is more like a pile of rubble. And really what's keeping it together is its own gravity. This was unexpected. So that's the kind of insight you get with, as I said, new data.
And that is, of course, what shifts thinking, and sometimes new theories arise.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Very exciting.
It is.
It is very exciting. And it, to me, I'm just so impressed by people who want to do this because it's such painstaking work.
Yes.
You know, we like to think of, you know, the eureka moment, but there's usually years and years of work that go into a eureka moment.
Yes.
We
yes.
just don't see that.
That's right. That's not glamorous. But I think to get to those epiphanies, you really do need to spend the time. One of my favorite aha moments, a moment of a scientist, and I don't remember his name now, but it's the story doesn't suffer for it. He's sitting in a cafeteria and he's watching this food fight break out. And most people would, worry about how they're going to keep their composure and perhaps save their clothes from getting messed up. But what he noticed was that as the food was flying, the ketchup was behaving in a different way than everything else. Because he had the information, because he had thought about the viscosity and texture of ketchup. He was able to study it, and it basically became the foundation for some of the seminal work he did and picked up a Nobel Prize as a result. So sometimes the data is staring you in the face, but you don't necessarily have the appreciation to ask the question, well, why is that? I would expect this, and instead it's doing that. So it can give you that magic moment of, you know, the epiphany.
So don't be afraid of food fights or put ketchup on your burgers. Well, Jean Creighton, as always, such a pleasure to talk to you, and we'll catch up with you next month.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, Bonnie.
Regular Lake Effect contributor Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She spoke with us this month about the collection, analysis, and publication of scientific data. We'll take one last break, and then essayist Mark Segrist is moving and finding it hard to find his get up and go. Stay tuned for more of Lake Effect in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio.